As many of you know, thank you. Move it over. Today is Shushan Purim. It is the, as recorded in the Megillah, the people in Shushan fought against their enemies in the 13th and 14th of Adar and celebrated Purim on the 15th of Adar. And until this day, the people in Jerusalem still observe Purim today. My parents are currently there, although, you know, since they're 6 hours ahead, it's getting toward the end. But it's Purim, as we observed in Jerusalem right now. Which then lends the question that, as many of you may know, this series is going to be about Pesach and the Seder and Passover. And why would we begin talking about Passover when it's still Purim?
Doesn't it? You need a month to clean.
You need a month to clean. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, I have my strengths, but I'm not going to be able to help you clean with this series. So I hope. I'm sorry to disappoint. But doesn't it seem a bit premature? Any thoughts about this? If you look at source number one, believe it or not, there actually is a pretty ancient tradition already recorded in the Talmud that before every holiday, and specifically Pesach here, you're supposed to learn the law for 30 days beforehand. This is a codified in the Court of Jewish Law, by Yosef Karo. We learn the halacha of Pesach for 30 days before Pesach. Why? Why do we have 30 days of preparation before Passover? We're still in Purim. It's actually Purim today. Okay. Yeah, so cleaning. Okay. Any other thoughts? Why would the Talmud set aside a 30-day preparation period for Passover?
Because there's a lot to learn in the Seder.
Yeah.
In the Haggadah.
Ah, so because there's so much to learn, and there's a multitude of laws and customs. We'll discuss some of them together. And learning them beforehand gives you some time. Any other ideas?
It's our national story.
Because it's so important. It's our national story. What was your name?
Lionel.
Thank you, Lionel. Because it's just such a fundamental thing. I think all these answers reflect the following idea, and I think that with that we'll begin our discussion, which is that sometimes we think, you know, we can sort of show up and that we'll just get the experience, right? Like, sometimes we think, you know, you go to your Seder night, however you observe it, and you're okay, I'm here. I'm ready to be inspired. I'm ready to go. And I think what the Talmud is teaching us is it just doesn't work like that. Life doesn't work like that. Right? Imagine if you were going to a play of some sort. And you had no idea about the background of the play, about what it was about, or what a play was. You just show up to this pretty expensive performance. Now, you lay out a lot of money to go.
We just talked about that, Hamilton.
Yeah. Hamilton.
You show up without learning,
right?
You have no fear.
Right. And you're going to walk out and you're going to say, that was a ripoff. I want my money back. I want a refund.
Yeah.
That wasn't entertaining.
Or you might say, I was so interesting, I have no idea what it was about, and you might Google it and learn.
Ah, okay. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. That's totally fair. But I think most things require hachana, as we say in Hebrew. They require preparation. And I think the idea of learning for 30 days before Pesach comes, I don't know that you need all 30 days just to, you know, to get through the night. But if you really want to get the most out of it, for it to be an inspiring event, then you need to prepare beforehand. And I think that's the message of the Talmud. And so, here we are on Purim, but we're still going to begin learning about Passover. And that's not inconsistent with Jewish tradition. So, I think specifically, though, there is something challenging about the night of the Seder, which also, and this also relates to Lionel's point, which also requires us to prepare. Preparation. And I'll ask you, what would you say is the goal of the night of the Seder?
To get it over.
Okay. Well, that wouldn't require too much preparation. Okay.
To give you the experience, to have you come out of it
Right. What was her name? Linda. Right. Linda is exactly correct. This is what's echoed in source number two, that on Passover, it is not enough to simply go through the motions. We're not simply going through some sort of ceremony like, you know, maybe we do yesterday when we read the Megillah, although it's an important thing to read, but we listen and we try to get as much out of it as we can. On Pesach, we really try to accomplish something much more difficult, much more ambitious, if I may. As if you look at source number two, and this is exactly what Linda said, it's echoed in the very Haggadah itself. We say, in each and every generation, a person is obligated to see himself or herself as if they left Egypt, as it is stated, for the sake of this, and this is a quote from the Bible, from Exodus, for the sake of this, did the Lord do this for me in going out of Egypt. The Lord did it for me. Not only our ancestors did the Holy One, blessed be He, redeem, but rather also us together with them did He redeem. As it is stated in Deuteronomy, and He took us out from there, Otanu Hotzi Misham, in order to bring us in, to give us the land which He swore unto our fathers. And so the Haggadah is telling us that we are meant to feel on the night of the Seder as if we just were redeemed from the servitude of Egypt. And the obvious question is, what does that even mean? Because, did we?
If you clean the house for 30 days,
it's a redemption from servitude. Redemption from the servitude of cleaning.
Funny crap.
Yeah, everyone's very bitter about cleaning. Maybe it has to do with... okay, that's true. Well, Niall hasn't piped up. It's true. Lionel, how do you feel about cleaning? What are your thoughts about it?
It's a problem because it keeps needing to be done again and again.
Ah.
It's not just that you do it once and it's over.
Yeah.
It's just repetitive.
Okay, so but I don't, and obviously I don't think that that's actually what this is referring to. Although, you know, I don't know how long they spent cleaning in the times of the sages. I'm not sure. They didn't have as much Lysol or cleaning agents. Maybe it was more difficult, although their houses might have been dirtier, for all I know. But what might that mean? Yes. What's your name?
Diane.
Nice. Yes, Diane.
I think this is one of the many stories of our being redeemed.
Right.
Perhaps when we repeat it, this is a very sad one. We have the Inquisition, we have the Holocaust,
oh, yeah.
We have a day-to-day reminder every day that we're Jewish and that not good things happen to us, and then constantly being reminded in the Seders, every generation we have to remember. Yeah, every generation we remember
right.
Is only brought to the forefront by sitting down and retelling.
Right. Wow. Thank you, Diane. Actually, do you know, where is there any place where that thought is echoed? Yeah, we actually say that on Seder night, that every generation, right? It became a pretty popular song. This is what has stood for us and for our forefathers, that it is not only in that generation that we were persecuted, but in every generation we're persecuted, and God stands up for us to redeem us. It's sort of this reminder that history for the Jewish people is cyclical, and it's a cycle that keeps on repeating itself. Yes. Any other ideas? What could this possibly mean that we had to see ourselves if we left Egypt? Any other thoughts? Again, it's I'll tell you. Yes.
Gratitude.
We have to be as thankful. Why so thankful? Why do we have to be so thankful even nowadays?
Because those people who we know around the world who are not free and who are suffering, and that's not us.
Right.
Society that's not free is not a democratic or fair society.
So it's about gratitude. And that's what... I love both these answers. I just presented to you here in Source 3 and 4 two different approaches which are similar but different, both from Maharal. Has anyone ever heard of the Maharal?
No.
Yeah. So if you know, if you heard of the guy, how's it going, Mish? If you heard of the Golem story,
yeah.
That was pretty much... I'm not sure it's more like a fable that was a legend, if you will, that surrounds Maharal. Maharal was a very prominent rabbinic figure He's known as the Maharal from Prague, though he was in other places in Europe as well, Rav Yehuda Low, and he's mostly known, although he was an expert in Jewish law as well, he's mostly known as one of the first to have a systematic treatment of Jewish thought. And he really adheres to the words of the sages and tries to explain them and give them a philosophical underpinning. And here, it's usually very esoteric. And so as we read these two sources, I'd actually like it if we could try to understand them together. I'm not coming here as simply presenting you information. So if you take a look at source 3, the Maharal asks the obvious question. If you ask, why should it be as if the land is Israel? This is actually referring to a verse in the Torah, actually after the Jews leave Egypt, where God says that you are leaving today. And Rashi, or Shlomo Yitzchaki, comments from the sages that you should see it as if you had just received the land of Israel every day. That when you go to Israel and you tell your children and grandchildren about how God brought you to the land of Israel, it should be as if you had just gotten there today. And the Maharal asks the obvious question. If you ask, why should it be as if the land of Israel was given today, if it's not true? But it wasn't. Who are we kidding? Are we pretending? Is that what's happening? Similarly, the sages state this about many things, such as the Torah, that it should be as if it was given to you today. When we got the Torah, we're not supposed to look at the revelation at Sinai as an event that merely happened thousands of years ago. Every day should be the day of revelation. That's what the sages say. And the Exodus. In each and every generation, a person is obligated to see him or herself as if they left Egypt. And the question is why? Why is that? Very obvious, simple question. Sometimes we read the Haggadah, we think, you know, you can't ask such a question. It's in the Haggadah, that's the way it is. But the Maharal is asking, what does that mean? So let's read his answer. But the main reason is, as we have explained, that there are certain phenomena that are on such a level, they transcend time. And as we have mentioned, when the Jews left Egypt, they cleave to a level which is above the order of time. Somehow, says the Maharal, the Exodus and what we achieved as a nation transcends time. It is beyond the realm of time. What do you think that might mean? That transcends time itself. What he's saying is it didn't just happen then. It didn't just happen at any given time. Yeah?
Well, the idea of being a slave wherever and then being free, you know, controlled and then getting some freedom, that, you know, through time.
Controlled and getting some freedom through time.
We're controlled and then, you know,
like having control of our time.
Yeah, like so we were in the ghetto and then we were set free, or, you know, we lived well in Spain until we were not, you know.
Right.
Sort of thing.
So are you saying that because we had the control of time, that it's something we celebrate as if it always happened?
Yeah, well, that's why, it like we were saying, for every generation there was a time where we were constrained and then there was a time when we had freedom.
Right.
So it's always the, you know, dichotomy of these two.
Okay. Anything else? I think it actually might have to relate to something, and I'll get to you in a second, sure, that Diane mentioned before. Tell me if you think this works, where it's sort of above any specific event. It's part of who we are. It's our cycle as a nation. It's beyond any specific time. Right? We reach this level whereby this sort of thing keeps happening. We become the nation of Israel that God chose us, and therefore it's just endemic to who we are that we constantly go through this cycle of redemption and exile. We're constantly going through it. Did you want to add something, Linda?
Well, I think just the idea of transcending time is just, it's the passing on of the excitement of the moment, you know, achievement in every generation. So that if it's transcending time, then it is as if we were.
Right. Well, that's what he's arguing. But I think the significance of it, I think what Dan is sort of saying, it's such an impactful moment. Certain things are so impactful. they leave their imprint on history forever. And it's beyond any specific time. And I think it does add, look at source number four, which is a different idea, but I think it's related. The Maharal says here, do you want to mention something? The Maharal says here that it's about the nation of Israel. And that we as a nation of Israel are not simply a collection of different generations. But the nation of Israel throughout time is all one unit. It's a collective. We have a collective memory. So that when God took the nation of Israel out of Egypt, he took us all out of Egypt. We were all part of that nation. He redeems the entity of Israel. And that part of what we celebrate on Pesach is how we're connected to this nation, this entity that's been here there for generations, and we were all part of that. Our ancestors and us, the people in Spain, the people in Portugal, the people who were in Israel 2,000 years ago, that's all one. And that's also part of what we celebrate. So these are lofty ideas. Be that as it may, I think we understand that what we try to accomplish on Lel HaSeder is very ambitious. We're meant to see it as if we are experiencing it. Now, that is always challenging, but I'd like to argue that it's specifically challenging for us today. So take a look at source number 5 and 6 for a second. Source number 5 is a pretty well-known verse, which tells us, and I think as many of us might be aware, that there is a unique aspect to the Lel HaSeder, to the Seder night, that it is supposed to be a generational experience. That it is something we are meant to give over to the generations after ours. It is specifically a commandment meant to be shared with our children and grandchildren. And to give them the experience and the ideas that we have. I mean, we have many mitzvot that, of course, we share with our children, but that's not emphasized as such. It doesn't say you have to read the Megillah to your children. Well, of course you're going to invite them to the Megillah, but it's not the way that the commandment, the idea, is formulated. Pesach is about teaching the next generation. It's about connecting them to our tradition. Now, if you put those two things together, number one, what we try to accomplish on Lel HaSeder, number two, that we have to not only accomplish that for ourselves, but also for the generation after ours, then that's pretty difficult. And then I just brought for you number six. Think about this generation. How many of you here have either children, grandchildren, or relatives, younger relatives, nieces, nephews, who we'll say are very digitally engaged, would you say? Who here has a relative under the age of 15 with a smartphone? I'm just curious. I'm actually surprised that not everyone's raising their hand. Right now, I'm gonna make fun of myself a bit, right? Like, I'm obviously haven't been around that long, but even from when I was a child, things have changed so drastically. Like, and this is, let's say, when I was 15 years ago. Okay, I'm 30 years old. When I was 15, in case you were guessing, okay, when I was 15, I got my first cell phone, and it was just a flip phone, and all I could do was text and like call, and that was it. No games, no internet, nothing. And children nowadays are so digitally engaged. Everything is on a screen. And I'm sure there are extensive studies about this, but just to illustrate, if you look at source number 6, the study here points out that there are actually educational consequences to today's generation's engagement with social media and the digital age. It argues here that with respect to differences, this is from P.A. Kirshner and A.C. Karpinski. It was just a study I found. With respect to differences on academic performance, the analyses revealed three major groups of findings. First, Facebook, that's what FB is. Do you know what a Facebook is? Yeah, okay. GPA is grade point average. Grade point average. Like how well you do in school. FB users and non-users were significantly different from each other, with Facebook users reporting both a lower mean GPA, generally a lower, worse performance academically in school, and spending fewer hours per week studying on average than Facebook non-users. through the amount of total time spent on the internet did not differ between the groups. Meaning it's not about the internet, it's about Facebook, right? Second, significant differences were found between undergraduate and graduate students for GPA. Okay, that I think we understand. If you're in graduate school, it means you're probably a bit more serious. With graduate students reporting a higher mean GPA than undergraduate, finally, the higher order interactions were not significant. Meaning, suggesting that at the univariate level, the relationship between Facebook use and GPA and hours spent studying is sustained regardless of student status. It doesn't matter if you're in graduate school or if you're in undergraduate school. People who spend more time on social media have done worse in school. And if you've ever seen how some younger children are with their social media, part of it, it's very understandable. It's a constant need to engage oneself in something else, right? It's, I have to Facebook this, they have to post on this, I have to text about this, constantly. How do you hold someone's attention who's used to that and get them to relate to something that happened thousands of years ago? And not only to relate to it, understand it, and hear the story, which they probably hear pretty often, but to feel as if they experience it themselves. I mean, isn't this almost an insurmountable challenge? How are we supposed to give this experience, which is our for us, to the next generation, which are so used to things being right in front of them, at a snap of the fingers, that they can feel and see and touch?
Well, Seder night, we collect the...
Yeah. Yeah, so it's one thing to collect the phones, but that accomplished something. But okay.
My grandchildren, I'm the producer director. They do the story.
Yeah.
Right.
And they all play parts and wear costumes and.
That's beautiful.
That's the
beautiful.
Way.
Yes.
Way.
Yes.
Here, because of Hamilton, we're doing it. I'm doing it in rap.
That is so cool. That is awesome. But I think that idea, we have to find a way to reach them in a way that they will receive what we're trying to give over to them. And that actually, what I'm going to argue over the series, this has sort of all been sort of introductory, but is that the Seder acknowledges that this gap is there. If it is a generational experience, it's inevitable that there is going to be a generation gap. Meaning, yes, is it difficult for in our time to reach the next generation? Certainly. But it was always that way. Because that's what happens as time goes on. And I think for that reason, the sages in their wisdom incorporated sensory experiences, things that are different about Seder night, specifically to engage the next generation. Things that we see, things that we do to sort of get them to ask questions, different tastes. And that is going to be the focus of this series. Yes. Okay.
I'm not sure most of us can remember our parents' seders, which many of us are survivors' children whose parents might have come from Europe. I can't speak for the Canadians, but I'm sure theirs weren't any different. And in those seders, more than likely, it was the elder Zadie, elder parent who ran the whole seder.
Right.
He told everything.
Right.
The idea of engaging the children really wasn't, aside from finding the Afrikaman, that was about it. So I think we who are the results of those seders try to encourage a more inclusive way for our children to participate because we really didn't like those old seders.
Right.
And they weren't as much fun as what our kids are getting. They don't
okay.
Get
and also if you have sent them to some Jewish school or something, they have learned new songs. And you make sure that they have, they
yeah?
Get there and they you have to have the kids participate otherwise.
100%, 100%.
But it wasn't what our parents did, and it wasn't the way we were
right,
raised.
Right.
We weren't raised weren't raised to really participate in the Seder because it would have taken away from the Zadie who used to read the whole thing.
Yes, the women were in the kitchen. I remember
them.
The
women were stuck in the kitchen. And
yeah. Okay. I don't.
So I'm saying each family was different.
Yeah.
We found ways to incorporate more, perhaps because we integrated more with other cultures, other families, other ideas.
Right.
To expand on the concept of how we teach it.
Right. 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 So I appreciate that that insight. I'm definitely not positioned to sort of criticize the people of the elder generation. That's certainly not the point. But what I do want to argue is that I think the things that you're describing are part of our tradition itself. This is not a new innovation. I think the Seder was meant to be this way. And hopefully you'll see what I mean. Did anyone want to make any other points? Or if you look at source number 7, and that is pretty well known, but Rabbi Moses Maimonides makes a slight change in the wording of the source we saw in source number 2, right? In source number 2, we saw the Agada statement that a person needs to see themselves as if they had left Egypt. Maimonides changed it a bit. Maybe I bolded it, so someone will tell me what the change is. But it says, in each and every generation, a person's obligated to show his or herself as if he left Egypt. As it is stated, for the sake of this, the Lord did this for me in going out of Egypt. Not only our ancestors did the Holy One, blessed be He, redeemed, but rather also us, etc., as we saw. What is the big change the Rambam makes?
Show.
What's the difference?
Demonstrate physically, whatever. Some way.
Right.
Ritually or some way.
Right. You have to show it. It's not enough to just tell. Right? Now, I don't think the Rambam is necessarily arguing with the first point. Meaning, it's not that we aren't supposed to experience it. It's not that it's just a play. But it's that the way to actually achieve what's described in Source 2, the experiencing, the seeing it, is through showing and demonstrating. That's how we can sort of bridge this gap. It's through the demonstration. If you look at source number 8, this is from the Chida, a very well-known Sephardic rabbi, also known for his, historically, he chronicled the history of a lot of the scholars before him. But here he has many different comments on the Haggadah, and he says as follows. A person needs to demonstrate through enthusiastic physical motions so that all present know and recognize. Meaning it's your body language, your enthusiasm. It's not enough, says the Chida, to think this, to feel this. You need to communicate it through the way that you act. And so, I'd like to argue, or begin at least to demonstrate today, that there are many things we do to make the Seder look different. We're going to focus on we're going to go through the sense of sight, the sense of taste, which is obviously unique on the Seder night, the taste of the Seder, and then ultimately the sounds of the Seder. Today we're going to focus on the sights. So take a look at source number 1, actually 9 and 10 on page 2, and tell me what you think. So first we have source number 9. One should set their table with beautiful utensils as per their means and prepare their seat for leaning in a manner demonstrating freedom. So that on Seder night, and this is the code of Jewish law, meaning this is actual codified law, that you're supposed to set your table very nicely.
You can't use plastic plates.
Sounds like you shouldn't. Sounds like.
But it's a lot of work.
There's no doubt about that.
You have to choose between using plastic plates or using very pretty, expensive dishes. What would you choose? If one will let you enjoy the Seder more, and one won't.
This is a good question. So you have to weigh. You have to weigh. I'm going to point something out in a second. But here's my question. Do you think, just to your point, is it about using? Because you mentioned that. If you look at source number 10 for a second, he points out, this is the Chafetz Chaim Yisrael Meir Kagan, has a very well-known commentary on the Code of Jewish Law called the Mishnah Berurah. He says makes two points here which are both interesting. He says, although the rest of the year it's appropriate to be modest in this regard, as a remembrance of destruction, meaning there's a certain reluctance in our day and age to be modest, to hold back from extravagant demonstrations of wealth or beauty, as sort of an acknowledgement that the temple is destroyed, there are problems in the world, and we have to be particular about showing how great we have it. So he says that's generally, however, on the night of Passover, it's commendable to be lavish because it's part of demonstrating freedom. And look at the second thing here. It was said about the Maharil. The Maharil was a Rishon, one of the medieval rabbi who was very prominent in Ashkenazic circles. Many of the customs Ashkenazic Jews have are from the Maharil. And he says what the Maharil would do is that when he took beautiful utensils owned by Gentiles as collateral, meaning he would have business engagements with Gentiles, he would lend them money and they would give him their beautiful utensils as a collateral to ensure that he would be able to collect the debt. Now, generally, we don't allow one to use collateral for their own purposes. Meaning, if I lend you money and you say, okay, look, I say, well, how do I know you'll pay me back? You give me, here's a beautiful goblet, and take it, and this will be your way of ensuring that I actually pay you back. I can't then use your goblet for drinking, right? Because it's not mine. However, it says here that when he took beautiful utensils owned by Gentiles as collateral, he would never use them except for on Passover, when his custom was to place them on a special table to enjoy their appearance.
So not use them, just choke.
Ah!
Oh.
Okay, so many, many problems are raised with this. There's the kashrut problem.
Yeah.
There's the kashra problem. That's one. And this is a big rabbi, right? I think he definitely cared. It wasn't that he didn't care about the kashra problem. There's another problem here, which is the problem I mentioned, which is that you can't really use someone else's object without their permission, even if it's collateral, but it's not yours. And there are those who ask on the Maharil, and they give sorts of answers. Well, it's understood that he would do it, and all sorts of answers like that. But some commentary suggests he wasn't using them. He didn't use the plates. They were just for show, just for display. Now, why do you think that's important? Yes, Moish.
Well, I don't know if this is what happened. You could say that he was simply fulfilling what happened in the tenth tribe. That they
were. Ooh, ho, I like that.
That is collateral. He's talking about things that's what the pasuk says.
That is a really. That is a really interesting insight. What Moshe is mentioning is that the Torah tells us that as the Jews left Egypt, this is a whole complicated question, as this, what the Maharil did, is also complicated. It's equally that when the Jews left Egypt, the Bible says that they quote-unquote borrowed the valuables of the Egyptians as they left. And there's a whole discussion, how is that ethical? Was it borrowing? Maybe it doesn't really mean they borrowed, they just asked. For them, is it sort of a payback for the years of servitude that they served to the Egyptians and without pay? Is it that the Egyptians gave it to them to say, go, we don't want you to keep them? Was it a land swap because the Jews were forced out of Egypt and they had to give their property to the Egyptians, so they just took this back? It's a whole discussion. Not for now, but Moshe is pointing out, well, that's kind of similar to what the Maharil did here. He borrowed the utensils. Okay, that's interesting. I like that. Yeah, it's really experiencing it again. Now, I'm not going to convey, please don't say that, right? Bergman says you can borrow your neighbor's utensils and not get them back. That is not part of commemorating what happened in Egypt. But I love that suggestion. Yes, Linda. Yes.
Preparing their seat.
Yeah.
I think the preparation for the Seder is very much part of the teaching. Because,
right.
I mean, if you sit, one of my daughter's favorite memories is sitting around the kitchen table and peeling boiled potatoes and peeling eggs and making charoset. And I think all those things that are the preparation for the Seder are almost as important as teaching children about the experience as the actual Seder. I mean, even if you get them to clean the car, I mean, we laugh about cleaning and stuff like that, but that's part of the experience. That's part of our shared tradition.
Beautiful. It's a really nice idea that we prepare also. It's not just preparation. You're saying that preparation isn't only preparation. That's sort of what you're arguing. And to your point, what do you think your little grandchildren or children or nieces and nephews will see when they walk in to, if you do make the decision to go you know, I guess China instead of plastic. I'm not saying that anyone has to. But if you do make that decision and you usually go plastic, what do you think the reaction will be when they see your table? Yeah. Look at this. Look at this. This is something different. Imagine if they're just there for show. Oh, like, what are those beautiful dishes doing there? Oh, they're just for decoration. What do you mean? Like, who does that? It's almost like a, you know, it's like a break front, essentially, but it's like taking them out of the break front. I think it sets a certain tone. It's not just, and you know, think in your mind as if we left. Look, we're celebrating. Look at these beautiful china. So we set the Seder table up in such a way that you can see it. You can see the redemption. Look at source number 11 here. And this is going to lead to 11, 12, and 13. So generally, there's a discussion in rabbinic literature as to at what age is a child meant to be trained and educated in Jewish observance. Right? Meaning children under the age who are minors, let's say for the age of 13 for men, 12 for women, are not officially obligated in anything, right? They're not obligated in positive commandments, they're not obligated in negative commandments, but there is an idea in halacha, in Jewish law, of educating them.
3 years old.
And yeah, 3 years, it really depends, if you look in the literature, it really depends on, you know, the type of thing. Meaning, some three-year-olds might understand, you know, like certain things, like you might be able to explain to them, you know, that we have a Torah. You could teach them Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, right? Our Moses gave us the commandments. You can teach them certain things, and other things they probably won't understand, right? There are certain things that you need to get a little bit older until you're really ready to be trained. So there's a fascinating discussion about when is it commendable to give a small child a cup on Seder night. Now, we know that there is a rabbinic mandate to drink 4 cups of wine on Seder night. That is the tradition. And I'm certainly, you know, relating to the Purim aspect of this is not about alcoholism. That is certainly a relevant concern. But there's a question as to which should you give a cup to the children. So take a look at source number 11. It's commendable to give each child who's reached the age of education their own cup. To give them a cup at the Seder. Now, if you look at source number 12, this is Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, the Chok Yaakov. It's a commentary on the Code of Jewish Law, which was quoted in source 11. He says as follows. However, the Maharel writes, again, this is the Maharel, the source of many Ashkenazic customs, that the discussion in this Talmud implies you should even give a cup to children who haven't reached the age of education. Meaning not only to your 9, 8, and 7-year-olds, but the little kids, the 3-year-olds, also get their own cup on Seder night. Now, many of you are probably thinking, wait, you're going to give them wine to drink? So I don't know. I don't think so. And he actually says, right, first of all, grape juice is a good point. But I'm even going to argue maybe just give them the cup. Because that makes them feel, you know, important. Well, I have a cup. I don't get a cup the rest of the year. Look at this. You know? And 3-year-olds love cups. I have, you know, they're cool. You can play with them. You can do all sorts of things that don't involve drinking with a cup. Just watch a toddler play with one. It's their favorite toy. So if you look at source number 13, I think he has a good point. Although this probably does relate to maybe some minimal drinking. The sages taught in the Braita, all are obligated in these 4 cups, including men, women, and children. That's the sages. And Rabbi Yehuda said, what benefit do children receive from wine? He's like, why are you giving wine to children? Well, that's what Rabbi Yehuda asks. He says you shouldn't. We'll get to what he says you should do. But the sages think that you are. Now, I don't know if you're giving wine to them, but the point is you're involving them. And if you ask, well, you know, what they don't like wine. 3-year-olds don't even like it. What are you doing? Maybe they like grape juice, but I think the response is it's not about the consumption. It's not about them drinking the wine. It's about the feeling, giving over this idea. Look, see? Seder night's different. Here's this cup. And they see in the cup, wow, this something special is happening tonight. Right? And there are all sorts of things that you could do with this. It's not just about the cups. There are all sorts of things. I know many children in school make their special Seder plate, and they make their special pillow and the pillowcase. All those are ways are conveying to them, look, see, tonight is special. And when they see it in front of them, it really makes it much more real for children. It's hard for them to get an abstract concept of I left Egypt or, you know, who Pharaoh was. So I think one of the next big topic, and it's a very complex one, but is the picture you see on your source sheet, on page number 2 over here. What is that in front of us? The Seder plate. Now, the Seder plate is actually not explicitly dictated in rabbinic sources. It's mentioned, but it becomes part of our tradition in Shulchan Aruch. And it's this idea that you have this plate with all the different things that we eat on Seder night assorted around the plate, right? We know we have 3 matzot that we have, the Kohen, Levi, and Yisrael matzahs. Some put them on the plate, some put it in front of the plate. And if you look here, I know it's a bit hard to see, we arrange the maror, the bitter herbs, which we'll talk about on the plate, the egg, the haroset, the shank bone, the salt water that you dip the karpas with, and you arrange it around the Seder plate. Why? Why do we do that? Why is that necessary? What's the purpose of it?
They're visual images to explain the Seder story as you go through the Haggadah.
100%. Meaning, yes, theoretically, we can leave everything on the kitchen table. And theoretically, when it's time for matzah, we'll bring out the matzah, everybody takes the matzah. And we could go, when it's time for maror, bring out the maror and give it to people. But we don't do that. We display it. We display it. We also do that. But we have a Seder plate. And there's actually a question whether you should take only from the Seder plate, not from the Seder plate, but it's to put it in front of them. They see it. It's to see the story in front of you. It's to use educational tools. This is slavery. And we all have different things we associate with these different colorful images. So that's certainly one aspect of it. It's an educational tool. It's visual learning. Yes?
Something you just said. So is it a habit or a belief by some people that you don't use the things?
I think common custom is to take some from the plate and then to add on. But there are those that say that you want to have it there so that you can see it. You're supposed to have some of it on the plate. That's the point. It's not only, my point being that it's not simply a means of having the things in front of you. If you don't have it on the table, maybe you're not going to have maror. Oh no, I forgot the maror, so you put it on the plate. It's more than that. It's that you can see it as you go through the Seder. And I think beyond, so if you look at source number 15, this is written by Rabbi Lezer Melamed. He's a rabbi nowadays in Israel. He wrote a really interesting work. You can get it online, by the way, in English. It's accessible in English. I would encourage those who have the time to look through. It's a very well-written work. He says as follows, saying the Seder plate is not merely to keep the foods close by and at the ready, but also because food commemorates and emphasizes a particular idea. And when we must keep all the foods in front of us to express the uniqueness of the Seder. It's so that you see it. It's that this is maror, this is bitterness. Here, look. See, this is what it looks like.
We also have a point in the Seder. If you live the Karaj,
right.
You actually
have
a point to bring it
right.
So that it becomes real.
Exactly. Exactly. It's all about making it real.
Especially for the next generation.
Exactly. Do you want to add something, Moshe?
Yeah, I think that it's important to note that perhaps the fundamental difference between theology and spiritualism is symbolism. And spiritualism is symbolism.
Right.
A need to have something that I can point to. The ineffable God is the one big dichotomy.
Right.
Because God is spiritual. God is only spiritual.
Right.
I mean, even for ourselves. But where we are able to use symbols, we use them. As in all theologies.
Right. 100%. It makes it not just theology, you're saying. It's this sort of collision between what we believe and what we think and what we experience. 100%. Now, it's just interesting, and as he notes here, there are a lot of different customs in regard to the Seder plate. They're a bit complex. What'd you say?
Putting an orange.
Oh, yeah, what you put in and how you make haroset. Maybe we'll get to that next week in terms of the taste of the Seder. What it's supposed to taste like, and is maror bitter, sharp, what's haroset? Yeah, putting the orange on there. Well, look, it looks pretty nice also. Oranges are...
Kashrut something with women wanting to be counted in a million, and one rabbi said something like, it is beyond understanding, it will never happen. It's like putting an orange on a
page.
Okay. Oh, I do it.
Anyways... So in terms of also what you put on the Seder plate, but there are different theories. Just to summarize, so it's interesting. So one approach is that it's symbolic. That's the main role of the Seder. And that's the point of having it in front of you. The Rama in Shulchan Aruch sees this as more of a pragmatic, how do you arrange the actual items? Like, what order should you put them in? So the Rama suggests that it's more pragmatic. Meaning, you want to put the foods that you will eat first in the front, the ones that you will eat afterward behind, and so on and so forth. So that the Seder plate is there to facilitate the actual performance of the commandments that night. However,
the Seder plate just tells me what to do.
Yeah, I never thought of it. It's written down.
Right, and that's sort of advanced to the idea. It's to help you. It's almost like an instruction manual, a visual instructions. And that's one theory. If that's so, then you really, and there's a whole discussion about which ones you need to be particular about. Do you need to eat all of them? Do you not need to eat all of them? There's a discussion about skipping over mitzvah. We don't skip over objects that we eat as a mitzvah. So if you put one in front, do you get into problems? But there's another idea, and this is and it's Kabbalistic in nature, but I think it's worth reflecting on. And he talks about it here, that the Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Luria, the one who really brought Kabbalistic teaching to the modern day and age. He really, there was Kabbalah beforehand, but, the Kabbalah of the Arizal is, the one that's really studied nowadays. And he argues that the arrangement of the Seder plate corresponds to the Sfirot. Anyone have any idea what the Sfirot are? It's a Kabbalistic thing, those things. So, on a very simple level, I'm not a Kabbalist, but on a very simple level, the Sfirot are different emanations of God. Meaning, they're ways in which we can sense God in this world. He has different attributes, not that don't describe God as he is, but how we perceive God. And he goes through, there's Chachma, Bina, and Da'at. Those are considered the main primary Sfirot, almost like depicting God's quote-unquote thought process, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And then you have a number of other ones which are sort of intrapersonal. So chesed is kindness, gevurah is strength. We have netzach, which is sort of eternity. Hod is beauty. Yisod is the foundation. Tiferet is splendor. So the Ari argues that each of these foods represents another one of these attributes. Now, and it's really interesting. I don't necessarily think that we should try to understand how that is. But isn't it interesting to think about, the symbolism of these foods on the plate? And to maybe even go around and say, well, what do you think this represents?
No, we teach that to the kids. We teach them, why is there an egg on the
Seder? Right.
We don't tell them. We tell them it's a korban, but we also tell them, all life begins in an egg.
Right.
So that's the
right, right, exactly. It's the symbolism of it. To use it as a springboard for conversation, first of all, about the symbolism of the night, and even a symbolism of spirituality generally. Again, and these are very complex, but in a simple level, they represent ways of relating to God, of understanding God. And to use these foods as a springboard for conversation, that's also what they're there for. It's not just pragmatic. Like, oh, now I can take the matzah, it's right in front of me. It's also symbolic, and it's also an educational tool as a springboard for important conversations. And so that's another idea in this Seder plate. We're taking, we're making a beautiful array of the foods to make it more real and lively and relevant to the next generation. Just want to check how much time we have. So I think we'll begin this discussion, although I don't know if we'll fully do it justice. But so there are a number of different things that we do on Seder night, specifically, and then these are not just as much relevant to the way we set up the table, but just different scenes that we create on Seder night to draw children's interest and pique their curiosity. There are a number of these. I gave you, if you look at source number 16, this is one of them. These are all codified. It's commendable to distribute toasted grain and nuts to one's children. If they don't fall asleep and ask. Now, how many people here, how many people's children or grandchildren or nieces and nephews enjoy toasted oats and nuts? Probably not many. But, but that's what they did back then. Clay obviously can't be. Chametz, kidney yogurt is an interesting point. But we could give them sweets.
So they won't eat their supper.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second. But the point is to keep them interested. Giving out treats to the kids. So I just listed here. These are all sourced in the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch. But there are a number of things we do to encourage questions. First of all, it's the unique setup of the table. It's the Seder plate. What's that? It's the matzot on the table. It's all the cups. That's part of it. Feeding the children sweets, as we mentioned. Lifting up or removing the Seder plate. Right? There are different times during the Seder where we pick up the kiara. Now, it used to be, it's worth mentioning, that the way the Gemara has it, they would sit and eat every person at their own individual table. They had small tables. People actually ate on couches, which makes the leaning much more understandable, right? Because now it's kind of inconvenient to lean. That's not a sign of freedom. It's just sort of inconvenient, and that's a whole discussion. But they used to actually sit on individual couches and lean while they ate, and each person would have their table, and they would remove the whole table during the meal. So imagine you're in the middle of your meal, and nowadays this would be very inconvenient, unless you have some sort of, heavy lifter in your family. You can literally take the whole Seder table without spilling all the china that we talked about earlier over and making it break. Maybe another argument for plastic silverware, but they would literally remove the table in the middle of the meal. They would take it away. Right? So imagine you're sitting down to eat, and you're a child, and you're ready, you're hungry, you're waiting and waiting. And the food, the table's there, and all of a sudden they take it away. Like, what's going on? What are you doing? And that's what the Seder plate, that's what removing the Seder plate used to be. We pour the second cup of wine before eating, right before we recite the Haggadah. We pour the second cup, but we haven't even ate yet. We already made Kiddush, so why is there a second cup of wine? But maybe the most interesting is there's something in the Gemara. And that's what I call in this fifth example, grabbing the matzot. Take a look at source number 18. Chotfin matzot. Chotfin matzot. It says, this is like a source 18. Rabbi Eliezer says, when one grabs the matzot on the nights of Passover, on account of the children, so they ask questions and don't fall asleep. So that is maybe where the afikoman comes from. What does grabbing matzot mean? Or snatching? We snatch matzot.
Hiding.
Okay, that's an interesting one. Any other thoughts? Grabbing the matzot. It certainly sounds like something the afikoman. So this is actually a fascinating discussion. I guess we'll go through some of the basic ones right now. There are a number of interpretations. So Rashi here talks about lifting the Seder plate. And that's something we've alluded to before. You take the Seder plate, you lift it up, and that's what we mean because the matzot are on there. Another interesting one, and these, I think, are not just interpretations of this particular phrase. They're also educational approaches or a demonstration and sensitivity to the needs of the children. The second meal explanation Rashi has, getting to the meal quickly. Snatching the matzot, meaning getting to the matzot and giving it to the kids. Why? Why do you need to get to the meal quickly?
They're hungry.
It's pretty simple. It's late. They haven't eaten all day. And if you don't get the meal quickly, they're not going to be able to focus. Meaning, it's sort of this approach. You have to acknowledge that this is difficult. I have to do the Seder in a way so that the kids can actually participate with you. That's one approach. The Rashbam actually says the opposite. The Rashbam says you should limit how much food they eat. Make sure so they don't fall asleep, because what happens when kids eat a lot? They end up falling asleep, and you don't want them to fall asleep. Now, you know, it sounds a bit manipulative. And it is. That's the truth. But the point is not, you know, you're not supposed to starve them, obviously, but it's sort of acknowledging that there's like a give and a take here. You want to, on the one hand, make sure the kids are involved and make sure that, you know, they're not, their hunger isn't completely incapacitating them. But at the same time, you know, we also, it's important for them to be involved. It's a responsibility in a sense. We need them there. And you can't feed them so much they fall asleep. There's a negative aspect to this also. There's the things they shouldn't do on Seder night, which is also important educationally. You know, there are responsibilities to our next generation to make sure that we're taking care of them. But also giving them the sense of responsibility that this is a special night. And you have to act accordingly so that you can participate. And maybe there are certain things you shouldn't do if they will prevent you from participating. Okay, so we'll hold here for now. I think the main thrust of this discussion is that because of the gravity of what we try to accomplish on Seder night, because we're so ambitious in what we try to accomplish, to literally to tap into that transcendence of the Exodus, to see it as if we left, to see ourselves as part of this collective nation, a collective history that happened to us also. Because of that, we are particularly sensitive to make sure that we can bridge that generational gap. And there's all sorts of things, the way we set the table, the way that we give each child a cup. All these things are there to make things visible, to make things relevant to them. And that's a very important part. That's not just, as you mentioned before, Diane, something that we can do nowadays to make the kids involved. It's part and parcel of the Seder tradition itself. So thank you very much. We'll pick up this last discussion next time. And have a wonderful day. And I'll take any...